We finished off, we didn't really finish, we were in the middle of a long procession, funeral processions, and all the different hospedim that were offered in those various, on those various occasions. We had the analogy of the loss of Rabbi Yochanan compared to the day that the Melech Yoshio died, and in his hesped, it was described as if the sun set in the afternoon. And that's where we left off. I think we can pick up again. Kinach Nafshei Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan, the first words on the line, about 15 lines up from the bottom of the page. Kinach Nafshei Rabbi Yochanan. Okay? If you don't have it, let me know. Wait another second for everybody to figure out where we are. Okay. Maybe a few lines above that. Kinach Nafshei Rabbi Yochanan. Yosef Rabbi Ami Shiva Ushloshim. When Rabbi Yochanan passed away, this great tragedy we spoke about last week, so Rabbi Ami sat Shiva, and he also observed Shloshim. Now that was not necessary, it wasn't related to him. Am Rabbi Abba Bered Rabbi Chia Barabba Rabbi Ami Da'avid Lagarmi Hu Da'avid. Rabbi Ami did that out of his own free will. It wasn't a halachic requirement, but something that he felt was appropriate given the his relationship to Rabbi Yochanan and his respect for Rabbi Yochanan. Dehachi Am Rabbi Chia Barabba Am Rabbi Yochanan, because Rabbi Yochanan himself was quoted by his Talmidim. Rabbi Chia Barabba said the name of Rabbi Yochanan himself, Afilu Rabu Shalimdo Chachma Eino Yoshev Alav El Yom Echad. Even the Rebbe, an individual's Rebbe, who taught him Chachma, now we understand this to mean more than just the Aleph Beis, but even the Rebbe who gave him the substantial insight and Torah knowledge, the maximum is one day of observance of Avelos, and even then it's not a full-scale Avelos as one would do for a relative. So Rabbi Ami was doing this out of his own free will. But it does shed light on the fact that you see clearly there is a concept of volunteering Avelos. And this is brought down in Shulchan Aruch. If a person wants to volunteer to do Avelos, let's say they have they're very close with their in-laws, okay, or could be a stepchild, where there's no, strictly speaking, any halachic requirement to sit Shiva. But a person, if they want to display that kavod, they're allowed to do that. Now, why do you have to tell me that? You can do whatever you want, you know. So I'm going to sit on a low chair and I'm gonna tear my clothing. All right. So what's the big deal? Why do you need a license to do that? So it's not so simple, because when a person is observing Shiva, they're also not engaging in certain things. There's certain mitzvahs they can't even perform. A person is not supposed to learn Torah, for example. The rules of tefillin are modified a little bit for a person who's who's in Avela. So it sounds like a chumra. It sounds like you're being very very machmir, very stringent. But it, you know, every chumra also comes with a kula, and we have to be careful. I'm bringing that out as a general philosophy of halacha, that prioritization of the different halachic obligations and the hierarchy based on what is not really an obligation, what's more of an obligation, is very important to have a handle on, because you may think you're doing the right thing and you're actually compromising in another area which is more important under the circumstances. But here the halacha gives us license to volunteer avelos. Okay?
I heard that you're not supposed to act in avelos if your wife's an avel or if your husband.
So that's a different thing. That's a different thing. It's brought down as Gemara in Ksubas Daf Dalet. Is that where you're coming from? Not so long ago in Daf Yomi? Okay. So the Gemara over there says that. No, you're right. I don't believe it appears in Moikatan, but you've learned it more recently than I have. The Gemara says over there that if you are a close relative of a relative who is actually observing Shiva, then you're obligated in the same dinim that they are. So that would mean, yes, if a spouse loses a parent, the husband or the wife also has to observe Shiva. Okay, brothers, close relatives observe that, you know, extra one more degree of separation. They still observe the Shiva. Now, no one does that, right? So the reason is we assume that bizman hazeh. Let's think about it like this. Why am I doing so? Right? It's not that I'm observing Shiva. I'm not observing Avelos because of the loss of the relative, because it's not my relative. I'm doing it out of respect to join with the person, the relative, who is actually suffering, who is in that that state. So we assume that bizman hazeh because that's an undue expectation. So if it's the spouse is mochel on me from observing that Shiva with them. right? The license to give that mechila sheds light on where the obligation comes from. Because if the obligation to observe avelus was, let's say, you know, going back to the parent, right? Meaning if, I'll say it like this, if a son-in-law or daughter-in-law actually had an obligation to observe avelus for the parent who died, then it wouldn't be in the hands of the spouse to be mochel and then let the other one off the hook. So because it's actually more out of respect to the avel, so then the avel has the ability to release one from that. But once we're on that topic, I can't resist from sharing. If the deceased was mochel, so there is a whole separate literature about when that does let the child off the hook. So there we would differentiate. Here you have Shiv and Shloshim. There we would differentiate between Shiv and Shloshim and the 11 months. So if a parent wanted to say, after Shloshim, you're done. So the parent can do that. Why? Because anything more than 30 days is Kibbut Avim. Right? So it's in their hands to release their children of that Kibbut Avim, the same way the parent can be mochel on any other thing, that any other form of honor that the child accords. The parent would not be able to say, don't observe Shloshim, don't observe Shiva, because that's not in their hands. That's a separate halacha of Avelis. When Rav Shapta's father died, before his father died, he told him, I want you not to observe the 11 months of Shiva for me, of Avelis for me. Why? He said, you're a public figure. People are going to invite you to their wedding, to the bar mitzvah, to, you know, you need to be places. And if you observe the full Avelis, then you won't be able, it's fascinating, this is what he's thinking about on his deathbed, you won't be able to provide the chesed that you have the opportunity to provide. So I'd rather you don't observe Avelis for me so that you can be out there doing what you do all the time in that role. That's all, right. On the contrary, right? So what happened? Shafter ended up observing the 11 months, despite the fact that's what his father, why? Because he said, I'm going to show up to a wedding. What's everyone going to be saying? Oh, everyone at the table next to me, they're going, oh, look at him, his father died. Right. So it's a tricky thing. I'll put it to you like this. You know, there's Maris Ayin, and then there's what we would forgive the play on words, what we would perceive as Maris Ayin. Famously, Rav Moshe Feinstein, it's recorded in the Teshuva. He lived on the Lower East Side, you know, right by the FDR. So he would daven mincha in MTJ, in the yeshiva, 10, 15 minutes before Shkia, right before Shabbos. Yes. His wife would already be lighting candles, and he would get a ride to go to MTJ and daven there. And there was a woman, a religious woman from the community, who saw him once, Friday afternoon, after candlelighting time, getting the car to go to yeshiva. And I don't know how she had the chutzpah to do this. I don't know how she communicated with him, but she said, Rabbi, don't you know it's after candlelighting time? It's inappropriate for you to be in the car. So Rav Moshe explained to her, I'm not lighting candles. We all know we have a little more time, at least until sunset. But he, in his great humility, respectfully responded to her and explained it. But he said, because you pointed that out and because it's something that could be misunderstood, I'm not going to do it anymore, which is also tremendously respectful for no reason. So it's not really Marasayin. Marasayin is when what you're doing could be misconstrued as something prohibited. I walk into the McDonald's, right? So we all know, you walk into the McDonald's, you go into the bathroom, you're buying a soda, you're making a, used to be you needed the payphone, so there's no Marasayin when there's a very simple rationale that anyone could think of. But the Maris Ayin is when I'm actually doing something wrong, but people are not going to interpret it. I'm sorry. I'm doing something which could be interpreted as, but I actually have a good excuse for it. But I'm doing something that doesn't resemble an impropriety. It's just that poor woman's, her misunderstanding of the halacha, not misunderstanding of the circumstances. That's a good way to define it. Maris Ayin is when you don't understand the circumstances and the person is doing it for some other reason you're not aware of. But if you don't understand the halacha, it doesn't mean that every time I incorrectly accuse you of doing something wrong, you have to stop doing it. Right? So that's why I wouldn't precisely define it as Maris Ayin, but Rav Shechter was concerned. Bottom line, it could be a Chil Hashem. It's not Kavod HaTorah. People are going to walk around saying, look, his father died and he's not observing Avelis that everyone else does. So
I asked Rabbi Ornstein once if I could say Kaddish for my grandfather when I was still single. So he said, if your Shev or Krovim are still alive, you can't say Kaddish for anybody, even though my mother asked me to. So he said, but I'll say it for you instead.
Interesting. So strictly speaking, it's interesting that he said that. Strictly speaking, it says as long as both parents are alive, okay. One person should never say Kaddish unless the parents there also have the right to say, I'm not uncomfortable with you. I don't feel any heebie-jeebies, you know, if you're going to say Kaddish. But the minig is, you're right, generally, but the other thing that you said, that if all seven relatives are...
I'm pretty sure he said, this is a long time ago.
It's a parent. Said, because otherwise you lose a parent, God forbid, but your brother's still alive, you still would say Kaddish, right?
First day, yeah.
Okay, all right, let's go back to it. So that's the story of Rabbi Yochanan, just as a, you know, for those of you keeping score at home, as they say in SportsCenter, the Rabbi Yochanan was the one who died. And who did we quote? We quoted Rabbi Yochanan. He was the one who said, you don't do anything more than one day of Shiva for a relative. So just, if you're following the progression over here, earlier we had the same type of response where it was the Rebbe who died, he had an objection to that particular thing, like to put the Sefer Torah on the bench or on the bed. So we're. I think this is maybe the reason why it's the next story here on the list. But it could be that that's just incidental. I'm not sure. Okay. Kinoch nafshid Reb Zera. When Reb Zera died, pasach alei hu safdana. Once again, we have this hu safdana, this professional eulogizer. This is what he said. Eretz shinar hara v'yolda. Eretz Shinar Shinar refers to Bavel. I think we said that last week also, right? Like it says in Parshas Noach. Eretz Shinar Hara v'Yolda. It was impregnated and gave birth, meaning he was originally a Babylonian nationalist. Mm-hmm. Okay. Eretz Svi Gidla Shashueha. But Eretz Svi, what's Eretz Svi?
Eretz Svi,
right. There's a pasuk in Daniel, a few other places. Eretz Shinar is referred to as Eretz Svi. There's actually one of the Bali Tosos is referred to as Rabbeinu Yosef Shahalach be'Eretz HaTzvi. That was his middle name was, he was in Eretz Israel. Think about during the times of Crusades, how many people from the base measures of Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam made it to, you know, live in Israel. There's actually, I'm sorry to go off on a tangent, I can't, you know, all Torah is like one big, there's a famous statement of Rabbeinu Chaim, right? Rabbeinu Chaim was one of the Bali Tosos, and he had a conversation with Rabbeinu Tam about why we, in his day, in the Middle Ages, why there was no fulfillment of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Israel. So Rabbeinu Chaim said, in that conversation, that he believed because it's too difficult, too dangerous, and it's too hard to keep all the mitzvot hatulis bars, and that's why we're not makbid on bisman hazeh. So that Eretz HaTzvi. So again, it was a big deal if one of the Bali Tosfos could make it there. So they named it after they nicknamed him Shahalach Eretz HaTzvi. But it's a pasuk in Daniel. So Eretz Tzvi Gidlo Shashu Eha. Literally, the word Tzvi means desirous. Okay, meaning a desirable. Everyone wants to be in Israel. Maybe it has something to do with the fact that in the Ksuba, the text of the Ksuba, which is Aramaic, so it says Vitzavi, Yehuda Shlomo ben Avram Chasan Denan. Tzavi means he wanted, he acquiesced, he instructed. This is what the desire of the Chasan that's recorded in the Ksuba. So Eretz Gidla Shashueha, the Eretz Yisrael raised its delight, meaning Reb Zera, even though he started in Bavel, he came to Eretz Yisrael and spent years there. The story is recorded in Bav Metzia. He had to fast 100 fasts, I think, so he would forget all the Torah from Bavel, and his mind would be open because he was afraid he would be too encumbered, by the mentality of the style of learning in Bavel, and he wanted to really imbibe a new, the yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, and the only way he could do it was he had to ask for rachamim that he should forget the learning in Bavel. So he came there, Oyin Allah Amra Rekas, okay? And woe is to you, Rekas. Rekas is a ki of the kli chemdasa, because you lost your, again, the vessel of your delight. Rekas is a Tiveria. Okay, so he started in Bavel, came to Eretz Yisrael, and ultimately Tiveria, which makes a lot of sense because Tiveria was the center of learning following the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Yerushalayim was in ruins, but the Talmud Yerushalmi was put together in Tiveria. That was the holy city at the time, the in the north. Okay, Kinoch Nafshei, Rabbi Abo, when Rabbi Abo died, Achisu Amude de Kisri Maya. Okay, it sounds metaphorical, but this is what they said at the eulogy. The pillars of Caesarea. And if you've ever been to Caesarea, there are a lot of Roman ruins. The columns there, the golf course there. They transplanted some. I played there twice. Okay, they transplanted Roman columns, archaeological digs, and put them on the golf course. So it was described as the pillars were crying. Okay, Rabbi Yossi Shafu Marzavi de Tzipure Dama. When Rabbi Yossi died, They said that the gutters, from the roof, the pipes from the roof were flowing with blood in Tzipori. Rabbi Yaakov is chamiu kochve v'yamama. When Rabbi Yaakov died, they said that the stars came out during the daytime. right? Like the like similar to what we saw before, the day turned into night. Rabbi Asi i'akru kol ilana. When Rabbi Asi died, all the trees were uprooted. Rabbi Chiya nachisu kipi denura mirakia. When Rabbi Chiya died, pieces of little balls of fire were coming down from the sky. Rabbi Menachem, Rabbi Yossi ishto talmanaya v'havu l'machlatzaya. When Rabbi Menachem died, all of the faces of the tzolamim, the tzelem, right, like the images, the idols, were melted and flattened out, and the faces were unrecognizable. Rabbi Tanuchim Bar Chiya is katzu kol andartaya. When Rabbi Tanuchim Bar Chiya died, all of the statues were also collapsed. Rabbi Yashiv, and finally, when Rabbi Yashiv died, ichasu shivin machtarta ben harda. The 70 tunnels were dug in the city of Narda. We'll explain this in a second. Rav Hamnuna nechisu kipi de barda mirakia. And when Rav Hamnuna died, like barat, hailstones came from Shemayim. De Rabbi Yosef nashe kipi de pras adadi. When Rabbi Yosef died, when Rabbi died, the stones of the Euphrates, you know, like on the two banks, they crumbled and crashed in the middle. The Abaye v'Rava nashe kipi de diglas. Ahadadi and Rabbi and Rava, the chidekel. What do we say the chidekel is? What's the tigris? Also, you know the sides, the stones. They ended up smashing against each other. And when Rabbi Sharshia died, they said that the dikli, the dekel, the palm trees, instead of growing and producing dates, they raised thorns. Okay, so what's going on over here? If we had time, and I don't think we do, we could go through each one of these, which seem to be metaphorical. Okay, but there was a certain imagery that may be specific to the Talmud Chacham who was lost, that they chose these. Again, it doesn't seem like it's literal. You know, the pillars of Caesarea were not actually crying, although we'll go back to that in a second.
Interesting. Balhai said that yeah. Really
happened. Yeah, yeah, okay. So I have a suggestion about that in a second. But at least on the metaphorical level, so the unique association, just to pick out one, when Rabbi Menachem died, so all the images, all the faces of the tzlamim were melted. So if you look at Rashi, it's the second to last narrow line, lemechaltsaya, or actually right before havu the tzalmanaya nimochu parts of shalahem, the parts of the faces of the idols were melted. Havu lemechaltsaya klomar nechlaka, they were flattened v'nismacha kol tzuras parts of Shotzlamim, and the nothing was left from whatever appearance you would previously be able to recognize. Vitzuras hamatbeos, and it wasn't just the idols, but even the faces that were embossed into coins, they were lost. Why? Mitzuras hachosid shenishtanis. So Rashi says over here the tzura of the chosid was nishtanis, meaning when a person dies, so you know they change color and they ultimately decompose. So there was. Again, if you don't take it literally, it was a metaphor that the loss of the image of a human, of a great human being, was such a disaster that it should be that all of the images should disappear. This might be the source for the concept of covering mirrors in the Beis HaAvel. Many explanations are given. The most practical reason is because there's minyanim happening in the Shiva house, so you want to cover the mirrors so no one's davening to themselves or a picture of someone else, which you're not supposed to daven in front of a mirror. But there's also a notion, the reason we cover the mirrors is to indicate the fact that the Tzelem Elokim, the image of God, has been in some way lost with the loss of human life. So here is a very, very graphic reference to that. Although there's one more dimension, the next Rashi, Rabbi Menachem benon shel kedoshim, shel nishtakel af betzura shel zuza. The Gemara says that Rabbi Menachem was very careful. This was a huge chumah. This is not something that there's any obligation to do so, but he was very careful not to look at the image, even the one embossed on a coin. We have a certain aversion to statues, you know, even if it's not something you're actually worshiping. For a while, I don't know if it's still there, on the fourth floor of Belfer, there was a bust of Cy Sims, who was, you know, the gave a lot of money to dedicate the Cy Sims School of Business. And I think, in order to give a hashkacha to it, the eyes were blank. Ah. You know, or sometimes they'll remove the nose.
With dolls, right?
Right, the dolls. Right. Again, you know, I'm not so from, right. but there are people who, they black out the eyes, you know, but... This was such a distance that he wanted to put between him and the Avodah Zarah and anything that resembled the Avodah Zarah. He wouldn't even look at the picture on the coin. So in that context, so this was the metaphor that was mentioned at his levaya. I think there's something we should take away from this, and that is, you know, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah tells us that, you know, why is it that we fast on Tzom Gedaliah? Tzom Gedaliah is a one fast day of the series, you know, four or five over the course of the year that doesn't really seem to fit. Because everyone has something to do with you know, a step in the process of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. First there was the siege, and then there was the breaking through the walls, and then ultimately the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, and so forth. But Tzom Gedaliah, it was actually after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, right? It was the last vestige of autonomous government, you know, that the Jews had before the exile was totally complete. Gedaliah was that governor, and he was assassinated, and that was, you know, that was it. Everyone had to leave Israel at the time. But the Gemara says we still include it in that series of fasts because it teaches us that shkula misa tzadikim kesreifas beis elokeinu, that it helps us appreciate the loss of a great person. And Gedaliah really was a very special figure. It's tantamount to losing the Beis HaMikdash. So we put it on par. Right? We don't fast for every time a tzaddik dies, but at least we have that takeaway. So I'm wondering, if you look in the Gemara in Sota, at the very end, there's a Mishnah at the very end that talks about, you know, how things change as we got closer to the end. You know, the beginning of the end, and then the end of the end of the destruction of Beis HaMikdash. For example, the Sanhedrin ceased to be fully functioning already 40 years before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. It started undergoing, you know, various exiles and ended up in Yavne and Tiberi and different places, but it wasn't fully functioning. So the Mishnah says that once the Sanhedrin was batel, then they no longer sang. The batel shir b'beis mishtos. They wouldn't sing anymore over drinks. That used to be, I guess people did that, okay? But that wasn't done anymore. And when the Nevi'im, the original Nevi'im were lost, then the Urim V'Tumim no longer functioned. And then it says in the Mishnah, and I always find this riveting, Miyom shachar beis hamikdash, ein yom she'in bo klol. This is the Mishnah. The Mishnah says that from the time beis hamikdash was destroyed, there's not a single day that doesn't have some sort of curse to it. Lo yorad atal of racha. Even the dew doesn't come down the same way, doesn't nourish the earth in the same way. V'nital tam haperos. The taste of the fruit, the Mishnah says, is just not as delicious as it used to be. What Chazal is telling us, and I think this should be understood literally, you know, especially if you have images in your head of the Meraglim going and taking these huge, you know, grapes and pomegranates from Eretz Israel, the nature in Israel was of a supernatural type. And when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the conduit and the vehicle by which the heavenly hashpa and blessing came was lost, and that was such a cosmic disaster that nature changed. And the agriculture changed. That's what the Mishnah is telling us. That there were physical manifestations coming up in Aser B'Teves. It says that when they translated the Torah, for 3 days the world was dark. What's that trying to tell us? It's trying to tell us that there was some terrible, you know, fallout of this particular event that actually, you know, that when we say the Torah is the blueprint of creation, when something about Torah is lost, creation also takes a hit. And the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Something even about the physical world we live in, it's not the same. It's not the same. I think there's a lot of practical applications of that, but I for those who learned this Gemara, saying that there actually were tears flowing down the pillars in Caesarea, the loss of, like we said before, the loss of a tzaddik is like Kesreifas Beis HaElokeinu, just like when the Beis HaMikdash ceased to be that conduit in the same way, there were physical manifestations when tzaddikim were lost as well. I think that might be what the Gemara is trying to tell us. Okay. Very happy to be turning the page. Once again, Baruch Hashem, Tana Rabbanan. We're back to a little more of the halachic discourse. Elu karoin she'in mes'achen. The following are occasions when kriya is performed, and following the kriya, in mes'achen, you're not allowed to, at least in a more permanent and strong fashion, re-sew the tear. Okay? And here's the list. We're going to, basically, this Amud of Gemara is going to break down each of these examples one by one. Korei al aviv al imo, if a person tears kriya for a parent, as opposed to a sibling, for example, if a person loses a sibling, the Gemara gives us guidelines as to when that can be resown. Al rabu shalom do Torah, if it's a Rebbe, tearing kriya for a Rebbe who taught him. Al nasi va'al abezdin, nasi, abezdin, the leadership, you know, there's these high positions also demand kriya. Al shmuos haros, on bad tidings, we have to see what exactly we're talking about, how bad does it have to be. Al Birchas Hashem, we made a reference to this a couple weeks ago. If a person hears the name of God cursed, they need to tear Kriya in response to hearing that. Al Sefer Torah Shenisraf, if a Sefer Torah was burnt, Also, Kriya is required. Al Ari Yehuda v'al Mikdash v'al Yerushalayim. If one sees Ari Yehuda, meaning cities in the region of Judea, Hebron would be an example. Okay. In addition to Yerushalayim, in addition to the Beis Hamikdash, right? Each one of those are separate chiyuvim. We'll see how that plays itself out. Korei al Mikdash or most of al Yerushalayim. However, if a person first saw the Beis Hamikdash and then he saw Yerushalayim, okay, I guess let's say he's coming from Har Tzofim. Har Tzofim is on the eastern side of Yerushalayim. So if you're coming from that direction, you'll actually see the Makom Hamikdash before you see the city. So if you would tear Korea from that direction, you would be able to. Then, if you proceed into the old city, you would not tear a full second Kriya for Yerushalayim, but just to add a little bit more to what's already there. Okay, but if you were coming from the other direction, if you went to Hebron, then to Yerushalayim, and then to the Beis HaMikdash, each one progressively, you'd have to tear Kriya further. I think the first time that I remember being on the other side of Yerushalayim, all the way on that end, was my father was had a Fulbright scholarship to set up the social work school at Hebrew U, and you know, Hebrew is on Har Tzofim. That's one of their main campuses. So he took me up. I was learning in Israel. That was Shana Aleph. Originally, my friends are like, your parents are coming to Israel when you're there? Come on, you're the most unlucky guy out there, you know? And once I started inviting everybody for Shabbos and my mother's cooking, they were they appreciated it. I appreciate it. So my father took me up one time, the beginning of the year, to his office. Beautiful view. But I think it was the first time I'd ever seen Yerushalayim from that side. And the only thing I could think of was that famous Gemara of Rabbi Kiva and his friends who were literally walking the same path, looking at the Har HaBayis, and they see this, you know, destruction and the shul, the fox walking out of the Makom HaMikdash. And I had tears in my eyes because we don't see a fox, but we see a big gold dome. But you have a whole different appreciation of what we don't have when you look at it from the other side. You know, coming down through Shar Yafo and through the Cardo and seeing all the heavily populated Jewish areas, then you finally get to the Kotel where there's 100,000 Jews for Brichas Kohanim. It's very different when you're coming from the other side. Very powerful experience.
So if you're coming from the airport, you're also going to go from, I don't know, Shar HaGaya.
Yeah,
You're going to see that.
Yeah.
I never heard of anybody whipping Kriya.
Yes. So it in theory, yeah. Sure. There are now some of the new routes that you come from the, yeah, okay. Yeah. People are, maybe they're not paying attention when they're coming in. You go to the Kotel, so you're paying attention, you're ready for that.
I had the same experience. First time I went to the Kotel was in 1946.
Wow.
And in those days,
it took you so long.
1946, wow.
1946. The Rachava, the Kotel, the square, I don't think was probably narrower than this room.
Wow.
And you couldn't really get to the wall itself because the Kapsonim was sitting in front.
Mm.
After that, the next time, was in 1981.
Hmm.
Wow.
And I walked out and I said, where's the Kotel? That's not a Kotel. That's a national monument.
Yeah. Okay, so now the Gemara is going to break down each one of these one by one. Ove v'imo v'rabo shlem dotor minol. How do we know? Parents and Rebbe, we put these together because the source is really the same. Dechsiv, Elisha ra v'hu mitzayik, avi avi rechav Yisrael uparoshav. As Elisha witnessed Elio, his Rebbe, being taken up to Shemayim in a chariot of fire. So he calls out, Avi, Avi, my father, Rechav Yisrael Parashav, the chariot of Israel and its riders, its troops. Avi, 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 V'imo. The fact that he referred to his Rebbe as a parent teaches us that they should be equated. Rechav Yisrael Parashav, Zer Rabo, Shalim Do Torah. So somehow, and this is a little bit of a discussion in the Mefarshim, how do you go from that, you know, the compliment that he gave him, that you are the chariot of Israel, how does that translate into Rebbe? How does it translate into a Rebbe? So we'll leave that out for the moment. Okay, we'll leave that out for the moment. But the Rebbe and the status of Chacham are equated. Rashi says, my mashma, kidematagim Rav Yosef, Rebbe, the tovlam li Yisrael, but salusei, mersikin uparashin. So the Gemara's answer is that the Targum, Rav Yosef, was the one who always knew the Targum. Rav Yosef was blind. So he didn't study Torah Shebichsav, and he focused more on Torah Shebaal Peh. Because you're not really supposed to, in the old days, you know, before the Gemara was actually recorded, you weren't really supposed to say Torah Shebichsav Baal Peh. Torah Shebaal Peh was oral, not allowed to be written down, and Torah Shebichsav is, even today, it really meant to remain as much on paper, and again, there's lots of exceptions to the rule, but strictly speaking, I'm not supposed to teach Chumash by heart. That's halacha. Not supposed to teach chumash by heart because that's Torah Shabbos Sabbath has to say b'chsav. Baal peh, it remains baal peh. So he said the targum, the unklus, you know, it wasn't unklus, but the targum of that pasuk in Navi in Malachim is Rebbe who you are as good to the Jewish people through your tfilos greater than the chariots and its riders and you know. So it was a metaphorical reference to the greatness of Eliyahu as a Rebbe. Okay, so what's the connection? So the connection probably is, we'll say it, we have time for it. The Gemara says that if a person has a chol in his house, he should go to the chacham and ask him to daven, because the Rebbe's going to have a schus that his tefillah should be heard. So that's probably what he meant, that you are the Rebbe. The Rebbe is referenced as the warrior, because the warrior has this power, and you as a Rebbe are powerful than any other physical weapon or troops or army, or because the power of your tefillah allows you to achieve more. Okay, v'lo mas'achin min olan. How do we know? Oh, you know, so I have to just let's keep going. V'lo mas'achin min olan. How do we know that in addition to the kriya that has to be performed, because we're going to quote the pasuk in a second, that also can't be re-sown. D'chsiv v'yichazek b'vigadav v'yikareim l'shnayim kiroim. Okay, that's the pasuk. That's what follows immediately after Eliyahu is taken away in the chariot of fire. Elisha takes with both of his hands his clothing and tears it in two. Okay, kirot mimashma shenemar vayikareim ein yodei shalashayim. The Gemara analyzes once. It tells me that he tore his clothing. Isn't it obvious that there are two pieces now because he tore it in half? So why do you have to say that he tore it into two torn halves? El malamin shekruim va'omdim l'shnayim la'olam. Teaches you that. It teaches you that that the obligation to tear is more than just to tear, but it remains like that. It remains torn forever. That's why the pasuk re-emphasized the fact that it was in two. Okay. Amar le Reish Lakish Rabbi Yochanan Eliyahu Chayhu. Reish Lakish asked the obvious question. We know Eliyahu didn't die. How can you use this as a source for kriya on the loss of a parent or a rebbe if Eliyahu didn't actually die? So he answers him. Cave in the civil row ode. Since the pasuk then testifies that he never saw Eliyahu again after that, so that's as if he's dead. So the Rishonim right on the spot say, so what does that mean? If I bid farewell to someone, I'm never going to see him again? That mean I should tear kriya? So obviously not. The halacha is obviously not. And could be you are going to see him again, right? That's what the Rishonim says. Maybe you are going to see him again. How do you know if you're going to see him again or not? The Meiri adds, Sod Hashem Li Reyav. Sod Hashem Li Reyav. That's a pasuk that says that certain secrets are revealed to big tzaddikim. So maybe what the Meiri means is that Elisha knew, he was told that he was never going to see Eliyahu again, that I guess he wasn't going to be invited to any more brises, you know, and that was going to be his last opportunity. So for a Navi to have that statement that there wasn't going to be any more opportunities to see his Rebbe, that was enough for him to tear kriya.
But don't we also, if we don't see somebody for long?
Yes, okay, that was my next point. The Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch says, based on the Gemara in Brachos, if you haven't seen someone for 30 days, then the bracha you make is Shachiyano. And if you haven't seen him for 12 months, then you say Mechayim Mason. As long as there's really a good friend that you're overjoyed to see him, you haven't seen him so long. Nowadays, we don't do this anymore because you talk on the phone, you send an email. People, it's not such a problem. Mechayim Mason means that a year went by, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, I don't know if you're still alive. You know, like that. That's really where it comes from. So I should be as overjoyed that, thank God, you're still with us. So that's an interesting connection that we make a bracha when we thought someone was lost, right? Because we don't know if we're ever going to see him again. But that doesn't mean that it justifies tearing kriya. So when I see you, I'm happy that I see you and I make a bracha. But it doesn't mean I tear kriya just because I don't think I'm going to see you again. You know, we don't go to that extent. We don't go to that extent. But that's okay. So that's the bottom line as far as the parents and the Rebbe. There is a question, and I don't have a good answer for this. I'd love to hear what you have to say. Why do we need a separate source to teach us that you tear kriya for a Rebbe? The Gemara in Bava Metzia, famous Gemara, says that if you have a choice between saving the Aveda of your parent or Aveda of your Rebbe, you have to return the Aveda of the parent first. That takes of the Rebbe first. That takes precedence. Why? Because you owe a lot to your parents, but your Rebbe doesn't just bring you into this world; he brings you into Olam Haba. So you have even more honor that's due him. And the same thing the Gemara says: if you're God forbid, your father and your Rebbe are drowning in the water. You can only save one of them. You have to save the Rebbe first. Shach tells a story about a Talmud of his. He went to be Masada Kedushin in Toronto. He shows up at the house, you know, before the chasen, knocks on the door, and he hears from the from upstairs the mother of the chasen yelling,
Rabbi Schechter, is that you? Did you tell my son that he's going to save you and not save me if we're both drowning in the water? So you have to be careful. You know, everyone has to use their discretion. Not everything needs to be shared when you get back home. But that's what it says.
So what did he answer?
I don't remember. I don't remember. That's the part where everybody laughs, and that's the end of the story. But the upshot should be that if you have to tear kriya for your parent, kal vachomer you tear kriya for the Rebbe. Why do we need a separate source for that? Right? It should be intuitive. I don't have a good answer. That's not my question. The Achronim asked that question already, but that seems like a very strong question.
Well, maybe it's not a kal vachomer because a parent, you only have one ever. And a Rebbe, if you move away from your Rebbe, you'll find another Rebbe.
That's interesting. Let me think about that a little bit more. I like where you're going with that, although we do have to define what it means a Rebbe over here. You have your Rebbe in third grade, and fourth grade, and fifth grade. You don't necessarily tear kriya for all of them. Rabo Shalom do Chachma means Rabo Shalom Chachma So Emeno, the one who really had a transformative effect on the person. In the same way that a parent, you know, has a major impact
right,
on the child.
But there could be the next Rebbe have a transformative.
Could be. Interesting. You're saying it's not as exclusive as a parent.
Right.
Not as exclusive. Okay, it's a very interesting answer.
Didn't we just say before also that with a parent, it's Shiva and then Shloshim. With if it's a Rebbe, it's only it's one.
Right,
Rebbe.
Right.
So there are
differences. Exactly. Okay, so right. So that is one of the answers that's given. We already see there's something inconsistent over here. The fact that the rules of Avelos don't follow the same logic we would have applied based on other areas of Halacha should feed into the Kriya as well. Okay? 100%. What you're saying is 100%, and that's definitely the foundation of whatever. We don't know how to finish that sentence. Why isn't it like that, right? Why it shouldn't be like that, that's what we're going to leave a little bit open-ended, but you're making an observation which is 100% on target. The Avelos and the Kriya, even though those are not identical, but clearly there's something inconsistent over here. 100%. Okay. 100%. He's drowning in the water. He's drowning in the water. How do we explain that? You know? You're right.
But that's the whole point. So for a parent, it's logical.
Mm-hmm.
For a Rebbe, you have to explain why you would save the Rebbe over a parent.
Interesting.
Okay?
Interesting.
If you have if someone wasn't well learned, he sees his sees his father in the water, he's going to go save the father.
Right.
No, but you're supposed to save the Rebbe because blah, 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 blah.
Okay, you're right. But the question is,
so that's why.
Once we have due process and halacha, so to speak, and we have that on the books, so then we should be able to just cut and paste and put that over here also. I understand what you're saying. There's a different psychology, but it's still a kal vachomer. It's still a kal vachomer. Let's just digress for 2-3 minutes, a little bit of lumdus. When this is brought down, so I told you earlier that there's a difference between, we'll say, a professional resewing of the kriya, as opposed to an amateur version. Okay, amateur version we're much more lenient about because you still can see, you know, if I would try to sew up a tear in my clothing, you'd know that I brought it to Danny's, you know, like maybe they can do a better job with it, you know? So that's the difference. Specifically, we find that the amount of time that has gone by is part of the question over here. For example, it says in Shulchan Aruch, Akol ha-meisim sholo la'achar zayin, u'ma'achal la'achar shloshim yom. For other mason, besides parents, the amateur sewing can be done after Shiva, and then it can be fully sewn up after 30 days. Okay? And for a parent, it's a little bit different. Only after Shloshim can you do the temporary amateur sewing, but a permanent resewing you can never do for a parent. Okay? But let's say after 30 days you can do the temporary sewing, and for other relatives, even after Shiva. Question is, let's say Yontif comes and interrupts Shiva. Right? Yontif comes and interrupts Shiva. So you tell me I can only start sewing it up after Shiva, but there's another 4 days left of Shiva. Happens to be that the Yontif came along and ended the Shiva. So does that even, the fact that the behaviors, the practice of Shiva has been stopped, does that mean that the parameters of Kriya also are cut off and I can re-sew it? Or do you say, no, it's still 7 days. Right? So what should this depend on? Could be this depends, right? How close is there an association between Kriya and Avelos? They're not exactly the same. The Gemara has a Lashon, Kriya L'chud and Avelos L'chud. For example, we said on other occasions, there's a principle, when it comes to Avelos, you can always select the lenient opinion. Halacha k'divrei hameikel ba'avel. But the Gemara says that's not true by Kriya. That's a unique halacha in Avelos, not by Kriya. So So what should this be dependent upon? So the Shach says, the Shach, when he's passing the Shaila, he says as follows. He says, even though the Rishonim bring down that you, for Kriya, you have to wait the full 7 days, because as we're saying, it's not identical to Shiva, but he says, the Minhag HaOlam, and this is just fascinating, the Minhag HaOlam is to be Mekel, if the Shiva is interrupted, you can re-sew the Kriya. Again, this was practical. People didn't have that many articles of clothing. They had to fix what they had so they could wear it. So what should this question depend upon? Why yes or why no? Why should we look at Kriya the same or Avela? So the Shaila is like this. The din that you can't re-sew the torn garment, is that a din in the Kriya or is that a din in the Avelos? Is it the pshat that if I tie up the tear, I'm reversing the action of Avelos, of Kriya, or no? Once I tear the garment, the mitzvah of Kriya is over. The fact that I leave it open for an extended period of time is a din in Avelos, because Avelos persists even after the Kriya is over. So if the re-sewing, the prohibition to re-sew is a din in the Kriya, so then it doesn't matter if my Shiva has concluded earlier, but the Kriya, if it's left open for less than 7 days, it's like I never did a Kriya. What kind of rending of a garment doesn't even last a week? So if it's a din in the Kriya, I have to keep it unsewn for the full 7 days, regardless of where the Avelos is holding. But if Kriya is finished as soon as you tear the garment, and leaving it unsewn is just a way to express Avelos by maintaining the unsewn garment, right? That's why the Avel wears it the whole week. He wears the Kriya the whole week, right? Even though he's not doing any new tearing. So then it would be logical to suggest, as the Shach says is the Minhag, as soon as the Shiva concludes, early because of Yantif, the limitations on the tear and re-sewing would also be true. We have one more minute. Another Shaila.
On the other hand, you can say, if the Kriya symbolizes the parent was torn away from you, then the Kriya doesn't help.
It doesn't end. Okay. Here's another Shaila. We know you can't sew up the tear. How about if I take scissors and cut out the whole section where the Kriya was done, and I put on a new patch, right? So I'm not doing the act of repairing the Kriya, but I am removing the Kriya from the beggar altogether, okay? So the Piskei Tshuva brings a machlokas between the Taz and the Chida, and the Chida, which seems to be the accepted opinion, says that it's usher to do that as well, to remove that panel and put in a new patch. So what lechor are they arguing about? So probably they're arguing you got to tell me what you mean by that, because I'm not sure. That's not what I was going to say. Is it?
If it's a din in the Kriya, then it's torn and you can.
You just pull it away. Because once the mice is done, then I don't need to, right? But you could still argue that by replacing it with, you know, a full-fledged beged with a patch, then I've dissolved that Kriya in the same way that I've sewn it up. I hear what you're saying. I want to think about that. So maybe the pshat is that the question we're dealing with is whether Kriya is a din in the beged, or in the, and this is touching on what you're saying, or is it a din in the torn, the what you've done. Meaning, is it the pshat that your beged has to remain unsewn, or is it that your action of Kriya has to remain unsewn? Right. Okay, so that may play into what you're saying, but if we understand that the Avelos is going to be a reflection not of my action, but wearing the beged, you know, I'm able to persist in that same state of mourning, so then making sure that it stays like that, you know, is still going to be required. It's not about that particular tear, but it's about making sure that the beged itself presents itself the same way that it did before. Okay, great, wonderful. Yashar Koach to everybody. Thank you, everybody on Zoom. Have a great Shabbos. Yashar Koach to you.